Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
This episode contains distressing themes and is intended for mature audiences only. Listener discretion is advised. On this episode of They Walk Among America, Gainesville is strategically located in Central Florida. It's a short drive from both Jacksonville and Orlando, and not too far away from some of the beaches that Florida is most known for. It's home to the University of Florida, which boasts of being one of the most comprehensive and academically diverse universities in the entire nation. Most years, over 50,000 students enroll in the university, known for its rich history and for offering over 100 undergraduate majors and more than 200 graduate majors. On any given day, Gainesville is teeming with students, many of whom flock to the Sunshine State from states far and wide. The summer holiday was coming to an end in August of 1990, and students from the University of Florida began to prepare for the new school year. It's a time of much anticipation, a time for fresh starts, new friendships, unfamiliar faces, and different classes. But the air of excitement in the university city isn't to last. It quickly transforms into fear, as a sadistic serial killer begins to target unsuspecting students in the sanctity of their very own homes. Hello, listeners. I'm your host, Nina Instead, and welcome to episode 39 of They Walk Among America, a joint production between the Law & Crime Podcast Network and They Walk Among Us, the award-winning true crime podcast. It was around 3:30 p.m. on the 26th of August, 1990, when police received a phone call from a maintenance man at the Williamsburg Village Apartments in Southwest Gainesville. He said he was standing outside the apartment with an anxious couple whose daughter lived in the complex. Frank and Patricia Powell had been trying to make contact with their 17-year-old daughter, Christina, for the past 2 days. Christina had just moved to the apartment complex in Gainesville in preparation for her freshman year at the University of Florida, where she was going to be studying architecture. Frank and Patricia made prior arrangements with their daughter for them to drive down to Gainesville from Jacksonville and deliver some furniture to her brand new apartment. They had spent the past 2 days trying to call Christina so that they could let her know what time they were arriving. But each time they called, the phone rang and rang before going to voicemail. Police in Gainesville were accustomed to such calls, where students out on their own for the first time take advantage of that college lifestyle and forget to check in with their parents. Something about this call seemed different, though. Christina had a roommate, 18-year-old Sonia Larson, but neither Christina nor Sonia were answering the phone. Frank and Patricia were able to make contact with Sonia's parents, who informed them that they too hadn't been able to get in contact with their daughter. The last time that either Christina or Sonia spoke with their parents was around 11 p.m. on the 23rd of August. Their spirits were high as they excitedly chatted about starting university. A couple of hours later, Christina and Sonia's next-door neighbor, Jason Beaupied, heard music blaring from the apartment. Jason was somewhat agitated. It was very late, and he was trying to sleep. As he lay in bed, he then heard pounding on the wall connecting his apartment to their apartment. To Jason, it sounded like somebody was hitting a nail in the wall with a hammer. Eventually, the peculiar noise stopped, and Jason drifted off to sleep. Over the next 2 days, Frank and Patricia repeatedly tried to get in contact with Christina before deciding to drive down to Gainesville. As they were driving, a neighbor of Sonia and Christina could smell something foul emanating from the girl's apartment. She commented that it smelled like someone hadn't taken the garbage out. A short while later, Frank and Patricia pulled up outside the apartment. They spoke with the apartment's maintenance man. He told them he didn't have a key to the apartment, but he would call the police and ask them to conduct a welfare check. Gainesville Police Officer Ray Barber responded to the call from the maintenance man and arrived at the apartment within minutes. They attempted to open the front door with a set of keys the maintenance man had.
We tried the keys in that door. Then we went upstairs. There's this outside stairs right adjacent to that door, which leads to an upstairs bedroom with another door on it. And we tried the keys in that door. Then we went back downstairs, and the Mr. Powell's with us, the young lady's father. We went back downstairs and went outside to the rear door. There's a landing that you can get to this building, to this apartment, from the rear of the apartment complex, and we tried the keys in that door, and it didn't work. At that point, I asked him, I says, the door itself is has a knob on it, but that knob does not have a locking device on it. It's just a knob, like a closet door would have, with no lock. But above it was a deadbolt lock, and I asked him, I says, would you like me to break out a small pane of glass, and I'll reach inside and see if we can unsecure the door by the deadbolt? And he goes, yes, I'll pay for the whatever damage. The father's saying that, the maintenance man says it's okay, and the father says, I'll pay for whatever damage is okay to the door. And we do that, and I reach my hand inside, and it's a double key deadbolt. It doesn't have a latch from the to work on the inside, and it appeared that the door was locked. I tried the knob and pulled on the door, and it was wouldn't open.
It was decided that Officer Barber would kick in the door to gain entry via the upstairs landing door. He asked Frank and Patricia to remain outside as he entered the ground floor apartment in search of their daughter and her roommate. He was immediately greeted by an unforgettable scene.
Right from the way the position of the door was, you could see one body on a bed.
In the bedroom, he found Sonia. She was lying in a puddle of blood on her waterbed. Sonia was on her back. Her legs were spread open and hanging over the edge of the bed. Her arms rested above her head. She had been stabbed at least 23 times. Officer Barber observed the grim scene closer and saw that Sonia's nipples had been cut off and placed in a plastic bag. He continued clearing the apartment, hoping to find Christina somewhere alive.
Went through the upstairs, went downstairs, and when I went downstairs, I observed a second female lying on the floor in the living room.
The first thing he noticed was the amount of blood in the living room. It was splattered all over the walls and the carpet. His attention then turned to the sofa, where he found Christina. She was lying motionless on her back, with her legs spread wide apart, resting on the floor. Stab wounds peppered her body, and there was evidence of a struggle. During the struggle, Christina had sustained 17 stab wounds, 5 of which were to her back. Officer Barber was stunned by the severity of the attack and the sexually provocative posing of the victims. Crime scene tape enveloped the apartment as students and media began to gather outside. Forensic experts were called to the crime scene to search for evidence connecting them to the sexually sadistic killer. Sonia had graduated from Ely High School, where she was an honor student and a keen athlete, before setting her sights on the University of Florida. For as long as Sonia's parents could remember, she had dreams of one day becoming a teacher. She wanted to major in elementary education and then study for a master's degree. A deeply religious young woman, Sonia was a member of the First Baptist Church of Pompano Beach, where she also worked as a daycare center aide and was a proud member of the choir. The children at the daycare center doted on Sonia and she on them. Jenna Lee Wagner, whose four-year-old daughter was one of the children Sonia cared for, said to the Miami Herald, "She was always very loving and giving. Every day she'd tell you something special your child did. It wasn't just a job." Sonia was also very artistic and loved to draw and paint. When Sonia moved to Gainesville to begin her classes, she wanted to live in a dormitory on campus. But when she was put on the waiting list, she decided instead to move into an apartment. Christina had graduated in 1990 from Episcopal High School in Jacksonville, where she was heavily involved in the literacy magazine and yearbook. She was remembered as a likable and energetic teenager who always had a smile on her face. Christina had also been a member of the girls' varsity softball team. Much like Sonia, Christina had set her sights on the University of Florida, where she planned on studying architecture. By 1 a.m., word of the grisly double murder had already spread throughout Gainesville, abruptly bringing pre-semester partying to a halt. In the early morning hours, Gainesville police conducted another welfare check. Krista Hoyt was an 18-year-old student at the University of Florida. She was studying chemistry and helped pay her way through college by working as a sheriff's clerk at night. Krista was known affectionately as Glowworm for her radiant smile and enchanting eyes. People who met Krista were always impressed by how punctual she was. So when she failed to show up for her midnight shift at the sheriff's office, a Gainesville deputy went to check on her. Krista lived alone in a one-story building on Southwest 24th Avenue. It was just outside the city limits, but was only 2 miles away from where Christina and Sonia were brutally attacked. Deputy Keith O'Hara responded. Pulling up outside Krista's apartment, he knocked on the front door. Nobody answered. He tried the door, but found it was locked. He canvassed the perimeter of the apartment and found the property manager. He said that he was conducting a welfare check on Krista and was told how to get into the rear bedroom door of Krista's apartment. He entered the apartment and called out Krista's name, only to be met by silence. The deputy searched the dimly lit apartment, making his way to Krista's bedroom. Immediately, he was taken aback by the amount of blood spatter on the walls and pooling on the floor. He turned his attention to the bed where he found Krista. She was nude except for a pair of socks and tennis sneakers. Her body was slumped over in an upward position with her legs spread wide apart, but it was evident that she was deceased. There was a large gaping hole from her pelvis to her chest where her organs were spilling out from. Her head and nipples were missing. He scanned the living room and found Krista's severed head placed on top of a bookcase in a ghoulish display. Her eyes were wide open in a blank stare in the direction of her own headless body on the bed. Krista had been stabbed in the back with such ferocity that the knife went through her heart and almost came out the front. Krista had enrolled at Santa Fe Community College, just north of Gainesville, to better her education. She was studying chemistry and had earned a scholarship through Burger King, which paid for much of her schooling. Krista was known as somewhat of a perfectionist and couldn't help but feel disappointed when she didn't get an A in a particular course. To earn extra money, Krista worked as a sheriff's records clerk at night. In the summers, she took on various other jobs to make that money last longer, such as babysitting and working as a clerk in a video arcade. Cliff Velkamp, the owner of the video arcade, said, "She was the best. She was very meticulous, very dependable, just a good kid." At around 7:05 a.m. the following morning, the sun rose over Gainesville. Tommy Carroll drove to the apartment of his 23-year-old friend, Tracy Pauls, after not being able to get in contact with her. Tracy lived at the Gatewood Apartments with another friend, Manny Toboda, who was also 23 years old. There was an intense fear among the students, but Tommy thought that Tracy would be safe because she was living with a man. The killer was only targeting women, after all. Nevertheless, when Tommy didn't hear from Tracy, he became worried. He parked outside the apartment and knocked on the front door. Nobody came to greet him. Tommy walked around the apartment complex and found the building manager. He explained the situation, and the building manager asked the maintenance man to open the apartment with a master key. Tommy stood outside as the maintenance man unlocked the apartment door. As soon as he opened the door, he could see Tracy's body. She was lying in the hallway between the two bedrooms. There was a tremendous amount of blood surrounding her body. She was posed in a sexually explicit position, and she had been stabbed multiple times in the back. The maintenance man immediately left the apartment, slamming the front door behind him and relocking it. He called police, and within minutes, they were blazing toward the newly found crime scene. The maintenance man unlocked the front door for the deputies, who conducted a sweep of the apartment in search of Manny. They entered his bedroom, which was to the left of the hallway where Tracy's lifeless body was found. The drapes were pulled tightly closed, allowing only a sliver of light into the bedroom. It was enough for them to study the gruesome scene before them. Manny was lying face up on the waterbed, his clothing saturated in blood. He had sustained 31 cut wounds and stab wounds to his face, body, arms, and legs. Observing the scene closer, he saw that Manny was clutching a small piece of black clothing. In a desperate attempt for his life, Manny had grabbed hold of the killer, ripping part of his t-shirt. Tracy had grown up in North Dade County, where she attended American High School. Her classmates were all drawn to her sweet nature, earning her friendships that would last all the way to university. Her best friend, Nora Strandell, told the South Florida Sun-Sentinel, "If there's one thing I can say about Tracy, it's that 100 people knew her and 100 people loved her. Every single guy wanted to date Tracy because she was so pretty, and every single girl wanted to be Tracy." Tracy was a homecoming queen and budding lawyer, studying pre-law at the University of Florida and majoring in political science. One of Tracy's lifelong friends was Manny. They hit it off immediately at American High School, and following their graduation in 1984, they stayed in close contact. When Tracy moved to Gainesville, she asked Manny if he wanted to live with her off campus. Tracy wanted the security that came with living with a male roommate, and a male roommate that was as tall and muscular as Manny. Standing 6'2" and weighing over 200 pounds, Manny had played offensive guard on the football team. He was also president of the Key Club and a member of the National Honor Society. Manny had always promised his father that he would make something of his life, and when his father passed away in 1986, Manny was determined to stay true to his word. He had just recently found out that he had been accepted at Santa Fe Community College in Gainesville, where he planned on studying architecture. Manny knew that his father would be proud. The similarities between the string of murders were evident, and investigators announced to the community that they believed that they had been committed by the same person. The specter of a serial killer loomed over the university city, and students scrambled to arm themselves for protection. Sales at local gun stores went through the roof, and locksmiths were in high demand. Some students took to sleeping with a knife or firearm under their pillow, while others were so spooked that they returned to the sanctity of their parents' homes. Stacy Green, a 19-year-old junior, told the Daily Breeze, "We slept with steak knives last night. I had to call my mom. This is unreal." Parents flocked to Gainesville to pick up their children from university, while school officials tried to assure them that their children were safe. At least, safe while at school. University of Florida President John Lombardi said, "We thought long and hard about suspending classes, but the problem we confront is not in the classes, it's in the community. It's clear that this part of the country has some maniac on the loose." Most of the 34,000 students at the University of Florida lived off campus, and while the university's dormitories were already full, room was made for those students. Those who lived away from the university were terrified. They surmised that there would be safety in numbers, so they all huddled together in packed dormitories. In addition to the dormitories, fraternity houses, sorority houses, and churches offered a safe place to stay for students. Not only were students nervous about being home alone, they were petrified of walking anywhere at night. Police Chief Waylon Clifton increased the number of officers on patrol at night, while Governor Bob Martinez offered 30 Florida Highway Patrol troopers to assist. The University of Florida implemented student escort services and bolstered on-campus security. The efforts did very little to dispel the fear, which soon enough spread from Gainesville all throughout Florida. The murders brought back chilling memories of Ted Bundy, who had left Tallahassee scarred 12 years earlier. The demand for constant updates on the investigation was high, and satellite trucks and reporters from all across the nation descended on Gainesville. To satisfy the need for information, police held two press conferences each day, but these press conferences revealed very little. The search for the killer was already in full swing, but investigators were remaining very tight-lipped. They released few details about the murders, other than that they were extremely brutal. They didn't even let students know how the killer was getting into the apartments. A lack of solid information gave way to rumor as people began to suggest that the killer had gained entry to the apartments by dressing in a police uniform or by sweet-talking his way in. Rumors also circulated that the five victims had been in a party together over the weekend before they were killed, and that the killer had been calling and taunting police. The fear within the community was palpable, as students and parents alike waited anxiously for details. The day after Tracy and Manny were found dead, members of the community and media squeezed into a briefing room in the city's police station. Chief Clifton stood at the podium and informed them that investigators believed that the killer was still in the area and that he likely had prior knowledge of his victims. He further revealed that the killer stabbed all of his victims to death and had forced his way into the apartments. With the investigation underway, the University of Florida and Santa Fe Community College temporarily absolved students from class registration and financial deadlines. Students were now free to return home until the killer was apprehended. For those who stayed, a memorial service was held at the University of Florida's Plaza of the Americas. They showed up in droves to pay tribute to the victims and chat amongst themselves about ways to stay safe and protect themselves. One student in attendance was 20-year-old Susan Wider. She said to the Miami Herald, "And I want to pray for the killer. I don't like what he's doing. I hate him for what he's doing, but I feel sorry for him. He must be a hurting man." The community were waiting on tenterhooks for the killer to be identified and arrested. Investigators were working around the clock as calls came flooding in from concerned members of the community. Some reported a suspicious-looking person or an unfamiliar car, while others reported hearing strange sounds outside their apartment. Each phone call was meticulously investigated, but none of them were lucrative, leaving detectives back at square one.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Students were back at school by the following Monday. A collective fear still quivered in the air, but things were beginning to return to normal. One student, 20-year-old Aaron Sotala, said to the Tribune, "Everyone I know is calming down. It has been almost a week, but there is still tension on the campus." Investigators had identified 8 persons of interest in the murders, including Ed Humphrey. According to investigators, Ed was an emotionally troubled freshman at the University of Florida. Just a couple of hours after Tracy and Manny were found deceased, Ed had struck up a conversation with a clerk behind the counter at the Daytona Beach Market. The clerk, Richard Lackus, noticed that Ed looked haggard and appeared to be talking to himself before he strolled up to the counter. Ed asked Richard if he had heard anything about the string of murders in Gainesville. Richard replied that he had not. "It's scary, man. The blood, stabbing, you should see the blood," Ed responded. Ed then walked over to the candy display, picking up a bag of cashews. He continued mumbling to himself. "It's scary," he muttered over and over again. Ed then paid for his cashews and three cassette tapes and left the market. For the past couple of days, Ed had been moving between his grandmother's home in Indy Atlantic and his new apartment in Gainesville. He was getting ready to begin his first year at the University of Florida. A handful of tips had come in to Gainesville police about Ed and his strange behavior. He was already on their radar when, on the 30th of August, Indy Atlantic police received a report of a domestic disturbance. 79-year-old Elna Lovatti called police after being attacked by her grandson. Her grandson was Ed. Elna had accidentally knocked Ed's contact lens off the table, and Ed flew into a rage. He struck his grandmother in the face and choked her. When police arrived, Ed apologized for his actions. He was arrested for aggravated battery on a person over the age of 65 and was booked into the Brevard County Jail. Ed just propelled himself into the lead suspect for the Gainesville murders. As students began classes that Monday morning, Brevard Circuit Judge John Antoon signed an order granting investigators permission to take Ed's footprints and compare them to footprints found at one of the crime scenes. Delving deeper into Ed's background, investigators subpoenaed his psychiatric records. His psychiatrist, Philip K. Springer, said he was opposed to being legally compelled to handing the records over and said he did not believe that Ed's mental condition should be a basis for suspicion in the string of murders. At the time, Ed was being treated with lithium, which is a mood-stabilizing drug, but oftentimes Ed refused to take his medication. His troubles had begun during his junior year in high school after a bout with mononucleosis. As a teenager, Ed was diagnosed with manic depression and was hospitalized twice. During Ed's interrogation, he denied any involvement in the Gainesville murders, but suggested that a man named John had committed the murders. Investigators pushed for information. Ed said that John was an unrepentant killer, adding that John lived inside him. John then emerged, almost as if on cue, and he began to speak. "I was just on a rampage. Oh, it was despicable. It was a disgrace on my city, Jerusalem. It was a disgrace. I was puking. Yuck. I had a blade right there." Investigators took this as a confession. They asked Ed to provide some details of the murders that only the killer would know, but Ed only continued in his nonsensical ramblings. With Ed behind bars, investigators descended on his apartment in Gainesville, fanning out to search the 10 square miles of woodland and swamp which surrounded it. They were searching for evidence which could connect Ed to the string of murders. The two-day search was not fruitful, but nevertheless, Ed's mugshot was plastered across the media, and his physical appearance fueled speculation that he must have been guilty. In the mugshot, Ed was glaring straight ahead, with a glazed expression on his face. His face was scarred from an earlier vehicle accident. Ed would be ordered to stand trial for the attack on his grandmother. He was convicted and was ordered to serve a 22-month sentence in the state psychiatric hospital at Chattahoochee. Investigators continued looking into Ed as a suspect. Their investigation was exhaustive, and it found that Ed had been over 173 miles away on the night that Krista was killed. Over in Ocala, Florida, on the 7th of September, 1990, the residents were going about their daily duties, taking children to school, going to work, and grocery shopping. The Winn-Dixie on State Road 200 was teeming with shoppers, like it is most days of the week. Suddenly, a man burst through the doors of the store. He had shoulder-length brown hair and was wearing a ski mask. He was also armed with a .38 caliber handgun. Randall Wilson was the manager on duty that day. The armed robber grabbed Randall and pointed the gun at his head. He demanded all of the money in the store. Randall was frozen in fear as the man traversed his way through the supermarket, ordering cashiers to remove money from the registers and put it in a bag he brought along with him. Once satisfied with his loot, the man set off on foot toward the back door of the store. He had strategically parked his car at the back entrance, making for a quick getaway. Once the coast was clear, terrified shoppers slowly raised themselves from the floor where they had been ordered to lay by the masked man. Panicked phone calls came flooding in to the police. Some were able to describe the robbery suspect in great detail, while others could describe the car he fled in, including the license plate number. A quick run of the license plate reveals that the car was stolen from the Tampa area. Police immediately responded to the Winn-Dixie and began their search for the armed robber. In a nearby parking lot, they see the car in question. The driver is driving around aimlessly in the parking lot, just around a block away from the Winn-Dixie. The driver of the vehicle immediately spots police. He pushes his foot to the pedal, and the car goes roaring off, heading east on State Road 200. Police give chase. Around 18 blocks away, the car slams into another car that was stopped at traffic lights, bringing the high-speed chase to an abrupt end. The robber attempts to flee on foot, but police capture him just a short distance away. Inside the car, police find the money that was stolen from Winn-Dixie and a handgun and ski mask. The robber was arrested and booked into the Marion County Jail, where he was identified as 36-year-old Danny Harold Rolling. During his arraignment before Circuit Judge John Futch, Rolling was asked if he had an attorney. He replied, "No, sir, I don't need one. I am guilty." 4 months before Rolling held up the Winn-Dixie in Ocala, a young couple in Shreveport, Louisiana, were watching television in their home on Wildwood Street when a man crept into their home. He entered the living room and pointed a gun at the couple. He shouted, "I need your help. I'm in trouble. I just shot my daddy, and I think I might be dead, too." The couple recognized the intruder immediately as Danny Rolling. They had known him as an acquaintance. The man attempted to calm Rolling down. After chatting with him for a couple of moments, he encouraged Rolling to put down the weapon. Rolling complied before producing another handgun that was in his pocket. Rolling took $21 from the purse of the man's wife and then fled from their home on foot. Meanwhile, Shreveport police had received a report of a shooting. 57-year-old Claudia Rolling told the 911 operator that her husband, 58-year-old James, had been shot by their son, Danny. James and Claudia had been at home on West Canal Street that evening when James got into a verbal altercation with their son. James had told his son to go outside and roll up his car windows as it was beginning to rain, and he didn't want the rain to dampen the inside of the car. Rolling stormed out of the house, followed by his father, who was carrying a handgun. The argument escalated. Claudia remained inside, knowing that the arguments between her husband and son could get quite heated. Seconds later, she heard 3 or 4 shots coming from outside. James then came back into the home and told his wife that he had shot into the air. He closed the door behind him, leaving Rolling outside. As James was explaining the situation to Claudia, Rolling kicked in the front door. He shouted at his father, "Old man, you want to shoot it out?" Rolling was armed with a handgun, and Claudia ran from the kitchen to the living room. She then heard a couple more shots before the house fell silent. Claudia returned to the kitchen to find James on the floor. He was bleeding heavily from 2 gunshot wounds, 1 to the head and 1 to the side of his body. Claudia grabbed the phone and called for help. Both police and paramedics responded to the scene. James was transported to Willis-Knighton Medical Center, where he underwent surgery to remove the bullets. He was in critical condition, but he survived the shooting. Claudia informed the police that it was their son who had fired the weapon. Police were now searching for Rolling. They knew that he was armed and dangerous. He was already on parole for an armed robbery in Mississippi. At around 5:50 a.m. the next morning, patrol officers spotted Rolling's Bay Chevrolet parked outside a Motel 6 at 4915 Monkhouse Drive. The patrol officers called for backup, and when they arrived, they surrounded the motel room the car was parked outside of. As they waited for Rolling to come out, some of the officers flattened the tires of his vehicle so that if he attempted to get away from them, he wouldn't be able to flee in his car. After 3 hours, with still no movement from the motel room, officers spoke with a motel desk clerk and a security guard. They determined that Rolling had never checked into the motel. He had just abandoned his car there. For months, police searched tirelessly for Rolling, but until the robbery at Winn-Dixie, he had remained elusive. Following Rolling's arrest, he was charged with attempted murder and armed robbery. Back in Gainesville, the weeks had gradually turned into months. Life began to return to normal. Students still took extra precautions, making sure their doors and windows are locked each night, but the elusive serial killer wasn't constantly plaguing their every waking thought. By now, the leads had dried up, and the case risked going cold. With no suspects or even tangible persons of interest, investigators in Gainesville began combing through old tips. Rolling's name popped up. While looking into Rolling's history, investigators in Louisiana noticed that he was in Central Florida at the time of the Gainesville murders. Then they discovered that he was also in Shreveport at the time of an unsolved triple murder, which had occurred in November of 1989. The triple murder bore a number of similarities to the Gainesville murders. It was a Monday morning on the 6th of November, 1989, when Bob Coyles and two neighbors carried out a welfare check on 55-year-old William Grissom, Tom to his friends. Tom lived at 2011 Beth Lane in Shreveport with his 24-year-old daughter, Julie, who was a student at Louisiana State University. The home was Julie's childhood home. She had spent some years at university, but decided to move back in with her father to work, finish school, and save some money. Over the weekend, Tom's 8-year-old grandson, Sean, was visiting. Sean loved spending time with his grandfather, and this weekend was a celebration for his 8th birthday. Spirits were high in the Grissom household. Julie was looking forward to a high school friend's wedding the following week and had just picked out the perfect red dress. On Monday morning, Tom was scheduled to drop Sean back at his mother's home, but they never showed up. Sean's mother contacted police, who in turn placed a phone call to Bob, asking him to check on his neighbor. Tom and Bob weren't only neighbors. They were close friends and had bonded over their love for fishing. Bob and the neighbors first knocked on the front door, but their knocks went unanswered. They walked around the home, peering into the windows and announcing themselves. Still, nobody came to the door and nobody responded to their calls. In the back garden, they observed that the grill was turned on and there were 3 burgers that had been charred black. According to neighbors, Tom was grilling burgers on Saturday evening. They entered the garage and tried the door which led to the utility room. It was unlocked, but as they pushed it open, they were met with resistance. There was something on the other side of the door preventing them from opening it fully. Bob was able to maneuver his head through the crack in the door to try and see what it was. He observed that the utility room was covered in blood. He glanced in the direction of the floor and spotted Tom's lifeless body slumped up against the door. Blood was seeping from slash wounds to his clothing. They could see that his chest and back were peppered with stab wounds. Bob and the two neighbors ran from the home and called police, unsure as to whether the killer was still inside the home, and unsure as to where Julie and Sean were. Moments later, police arrived at the Grissom household and began to search. A television was blaring loudly from somewhere inside the home. They followed the sound to the den where they found Sean. He was sprawled out, face down on the floor with a single stab wound to his back. He had been stabbed with such force that it had entered his back and then exited out his chest. They continued in their sweep, entering the master bedroom. The bedroom was illuminated by the open curtains, allowing them to see Julie. She was lying on her back and draped over the end of the bed. Her legs were spread open, resting on the floor with her hair flowing over the bed. Her arms were contorted above her head. She had been sexually assaulted and then stabbed several times in the back. There was an odd stench in the room. It was determined that the stench was vinegar. It had been poured all over Julie's body, most likely in an attempt to conceal evidence. Investigators in Louisiana had contacted investigators in Gainesville to inform them of the similarities between their murders and the triple murder in Shreveport, which had gone unsolved. They gave them Rowling's name and a synopsis of all his prior crimes. Rowling had a criminal record as long as a clothesline. He had been born the 26th of May, 1954, to parents James and Claudia Rowling. The family lived in Sunset Acres, a quiet, suburban, middle-class neighborhood where people like to keep their lawns well manicured. Rowling was the first of two sons, and Claudia blamed much of her son's troubles on her abusive husband. She once wrote to a Hillsborough County judge, "Danny was told from the time he could understand that he would be dead or in jail before he reached 15 years of age." James worked as a police officer for 23 years, making his way up the ranks to lieutenant. While in his place of employment he was known to be a soft touch, life at the Rowling's ranch-style home was the complete opposite. Even before Rowling was born, James had told Claudia that he didn't want him and warned Claudia that she better not pay him too much attention. James had a hot temper, and his anger was almost always directed at his eldest son, who had been forbidden from reaching out to his own mother as a source of comfort or love. As Rowling grew into a child, he began to fight back. He became unruly, ignoring his father when he attempted to scold him. James responded by tightening the rules in the home. He forbade Rowling from eating dinner at the table with the family and ordered him to constantly be out of his sight. "I am the law," James bellowed to his son. Neighbors watched on in horror as Rowling was routinely beaten by James in the backyard. Some feared that one day James would go one step too far and kill his son. While Claudia was prohibited from showing her son any affection, she tried her hardest to protect him, admonishing James whenever she thought he was being too rough. The environment in the family home was too much for Claudia to bear at times, and she attempted suicide once, later suffering from a mental breakdown. She often threatened to leave James, but the threats were always empty. Claudia always came back, and James never changed. Rowling later commented on his childhood. "I thought of a good way to describe how my life was as a child. I was a yo-yo on a string, and my dad had that string tied around his finger. What does a yo-yo do? It goes up and down, right? How do you make it go up and down? With your finger, right?" Once Rowling was in his teens, he began to rebel even further. He spent most of his time away from the family home, wandering around aimlessly, dabbling in alcohol and drugs. One night when Rowling came home drunk, James had him arrested, and he spent 2 weeks in jail. This incident completely obliterated any trust that Rowling had left in his father. He later said, "Because if your own dad would put you in jail, who can you trust?" After dropping out of high school following his sophomore year, Rowling enrolled in the Air Force. While here, he was caught in possession of marijuana and was sent to see a psychiatrist who diagnosed him with a personality disorder. After just 2 years in the Air Force, Rowling was discharged under honorable conditions. The discharge came just 30 days before Rowling was sent to Vietnam, and he was distraught. He thought that by being sent to Vietnam, he would finally make his father proud, but now he was back in Shreveport with a disappointed father and an exasperated mother. Rowling didn't remain at the family home for long. He moved in with his grandparents, but spent much of his time wandering the streets, getting drunk or getting high, much like he had spent his youth. In September of 1975, Rowling, who was now 20 years old, married O'Mather Helco. They managed to get by with her salary as a cashier and his salary from working at a loading dock. In March of 1976, O'Mather gave birth to a baby girl, Kylie Danielle Rowling. Rowling tried to change his ways. He quit drinking and taking drugs, and he found more steady work to try and provide them with the kind of life he had been denied. The reinvented Rowling wasn't to last. He returned to his old ways, spending nights and even days away from the home on alcohol and drug binges. His behavior was becoming increasingly erratic. On occasion, he forced O'Mather to sit with Kylie in the car as he worked eight-hour shifts. In July of 1978, Rowling accused O'Mather of having an affair. She denied that she was, but Rowling responded by grabbing a shotgun and holding it to her head. It was the final straw. O'Mather fled from the home that night with Kylie, and they never saw Rowling again. Coincidentally, O'Mather was a petite woman with brunette hair, much like the female victims in Gainesville. Over the next 10 years, Rowling bounced around from state to state, picking up convictions along the way. In 1979, he was convicted of robbing a Winn-Dixie in Columbus, Georgia. He was sentenced to 6 years in prison, but was paroled in 1982. Rowling pleaded guilty to robbery and grand theft in 1986 after holding up a Kroger supermarket in Clinton, Mississippi. He was sentenced to 5 years in prison, but was paroled in 1988. With nowhere to go and no money or reliable connections, Rowling returned to his parents' home in Shreveport. Here, he struggled to hold down a job, bouncing from menial job to menial job. Those who knew Rowling referred to him as having a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde personality. Some days, he would sit and play the guitar for the neighborhood children on his parents' porch. Other days, he could be spotted running around the neighborhood in full camouflage with a knife strapped to his leg. This behavior earned him the nickname Rambo among neighborhood kids, who were never quite sure whether to approach him or run away from him. During one stint in prison, he shaved off his eyebrows and suggested that the state should cut off his hands. As Detective Jerry Blankenship commented to the Miami Herald, "He did it to get attention, I guess. He was kind of weird. I thought at the time he might have some kind of mental impairment." In June of 1989, Rowling found employment as a host at Pancho's Mexican Buffet in Shreveport. 5 months later, the city was rocked by the gruesome triple murder of the Grissom family, who lived just a couple blocks away from Pancho's Mexican Buffet. Earlier that day, Rowling had been fired from the restaurant after failing to show up for his shift for the past couple of days. Rowling stormed out of the restaurant, but not before threatening to kill the manager and the cook. On the 19th of May, 1990, Rowling and his father got into an argument which spilled outside. James grabbed his gun like he had done so a handful of times in the past. As Rowling and James hurled insults at one another in the pouring rain, James fired 3 shots into the air. Rowling took cover behind a shed as James returned inside, unsure as to whether his father was going to kill him or not. Once James retreated back into the home, Rowling grabbed 2 handguns that were stored in the shed. He followed his father into the home, kicking the door wide open and firing at James as he stood in the kitchen. On the run from police for attempted murder, Rowling crisscrossed through the United States using false identities and committing armed robberies in banks and grocery stores, as well as burglarizing homes. In August of 1990, he found himself in Gainesville. He checked himself into the University Inn on the 18th of August. His only company during his stay was Denise Taylor, a local sex worker who met Rowling when he purchased crack cocaine from her. Denise undressed in the seedy motel room, and as she lay naked, Rowling pulled out a small case which contained a collection of knives. She recalled, "He didn't hurt me. He just took one of the knives and was rubbing it against me." He asked Denise to pose nude on the bed as he placed a compact mirror on the floor between her legs. By the 23rd of August, Rowling ran out of money. He checked out of the hotel and set up camp in a patch of woods near the intersection of Archer Road and 34th Street. It was a popular haunt for transients and those who struggled with addiction. Less than 24 hours later, Christina Powell and Sonia Larson would be attacked in their apartment. Rowling stayed at the campsite for just 5 nights. On the 27th of August, he robbed a First Union National Bank in Gainesville. The following night, police spotted him and another man, Tony Danzi, walking in a patch of woods around a block away from the park. When Rowling spotted the officers, he took off running. Police were unable to catch up with him, but a sniffer dog was brought in. The sniffer dog was able to find Rowling's now vacant campsite, and a search of the campsite revealed a wad of money that was stained red by the dye pack that had exploded when Rowling made off with cash from the bank. They also found a 9mm semi-automatic pistol, ski mask, jewelry, a screwdriver, a Panasonic cassette player, and tape. Despite the fact that the bank robbery happened just a couple blocks away from where Krista was killed, investigators didn't link the two cases. They had failed to do so because they arrested the wrong man in connection with the bank robbery, Michael J. Martin, who was camping out in the same area and looked somewhat similar to Rowling. In January, investigators began looking into Rowling as a potential suspect. They went back to the items found at the campsite, including the cassette player and tape. Investigators put the tape into the cassette player and pressed play. The recording is of Rowling. He's playing his guitar and singing songs that he had written. There was one song titled Mystery Rider. The lyrics pique the interest of investigators. Mystery Rider, what's your name? You're a killer, a drifter gone insane. Mystery Rider, what's your game? You're a rebel no one can tame. The final recording on the tape was recorded the night before the first murder. In a low voice, Rowling said, I've got to sign off now. There's something I've got to go do. As for the screwdriver, investigators determined that it was similar to the one that was used to pry open windows at Krista, Tracy, and Manny's apartments. Armed with probable cause, investigators from Gainesville descended on the Ocala jail on the 8th of February to serve Rowling with a search warrant for blood, pubic hair, saliva, and fingerprints. As investigators in Shreveport were making connections between Rowling and the Grissom murders, the DNA evidence came back from Gainesville. Rowling's DNA matched the DNA retrieved from semen at all three of the Gainesville murder scenes. As the prosecution and defense team were preparing for trial, Rowling was convicted of the Ocala Winn-Dixie robbery and was sentenced to life in prison as a habitual offender. In 1993, Rowling requested to meet with investigators in prison without his lawyers present. He arranged for another inmate, Bobby Lewis, to speak on his behalf. While Rowling had initially denied any involvement in the Gainesville murders, he was ready to confess. Bobby revealed details of the five murders that were never public, details that only the killer would know. At the time of the Gainesville murders, Bobby was in prison, so investigators knew that the words were coming from Rowling as opposed to Bobby. As Bobby spoke, Rowling nodded his head in agreement, even blurting out additional details that Bobby had not remembered. He went into gruesome detail, telling investigators exactly how he had carried out the murders. In the early morning hours of the 24th of August, Rowling broke into the apartment shared by Sonia and Christina. He was armed with an automatic pistol and a Marine Corps K-bar knife. He observed Christina asleep downstairs. He stood over her for a couple of moments, watching her sleep. Then he crept up the stairs where he found Sonia fast asleep in her bed. He paused for a couple of minutes, deciding which of the two he wanted to rape. He decided on Christina. He clutched onto his knife tightly and raised it above his head before bringing it down with full force on Sonia's chest. Rowling then covered Sonia's mouth with a piece of duct tape to try and muffle her screams as he continued to stab her. Sonia fought hard for her life, sustaining a number of defensive wounds to her arms. After killing Sonia, Rowling returned downstairs to where Christina was asleep on the sofa. She was abruptly awoken when Rowling pressed a piece of duct tape to her mouth. He then bound Christina and cut off her clothing. Then he sexually assaulted her. As she cried out, Rowling ordered her to take the pain. Afterwards, Rowling forced Christina to lie face down on the floor. He then stabbed her 5 times in the back. Before leaving the apartment, Rowling posed both bodies. Around 42 hours later, Rowling broke into Krista's apartment by prying open the sliding glass door with a screwdriver. Like before, he was armed with an automatic pistol and a Marine Corps K-bar knife. The apartment was empty. Krista was playing racquetball with a friend, but Rowling knew that a young woman lived there. He waited in the living room for Krista to return. He surprised her from behind, placing her in a chokehold. Once subdued, Rowling bound Krista and led her into the bedroom, where he ripped off her clothing and sexually assaulted her. Rowling then ordered Krista to lay face down on the bed, where he stabbed her in the back. He then mutilated Krista's body and posed it for maximum shock value. This time, Rowling had taken it to a new extreme by decapitating Krista and posing her head so that it would greet the person who found her body. In the early hours of the following morning, Rowling was stalking the University City for another victim. At around 3 a.m., Rowling entered the apartment of Tracy and Manny. He slowly approached Manny, who was sleeping in his bedroom. He stabbed him once in the stomach. Manny was jolted awake by the rush of pain through his body. He attempted to fend off the blows that came crashing down from Rowling. The attack was a frenzied one. Manny was stabbed all over his body and face, eventually bleeding to death in bed, but not before reaching out and ripping a portion of Rowling's shirt. The ferocity of the murder had awoken Tracy, who was asleep next door. Tracy approached Manny's bedroom and caught a glimpse of Rowling, who was covered in Manny's blood. She fled to her bedroom, where she attempted to lock her door. She wasn't a match for Rowling, who burst his way through. Tracy was terrified as Rowling turned his attention to her. She was shuddering in fear as she asked him, "You're the one, aren't you?" He replied, "Yeah, I'm the one." Rowling then bound Tracy's hands and gagged her with duct tape. He cut off her clothing with his knife before he sexually assaulted her. As Tracy lay immobile on her stomach, Rowling thrust the knife into her back. Like the other female victims before, Rowling arranged Tracy's body and then fled the apartment. Danny Rowling was ordered to stand trial in February of 1994. If convicted, the prosecution were seeking the death penalty. The trial was ready to begin on the 15th of February, but instead, Rowling pleaded guilty to the 5 Gainesville murders. He commented to the judge, "There are some things you can't run from, this being one of them." The guilty plea meant that the trial would go straight to the sentencing phase. The prosecution were seeking the death penalty, while the defense were hoping for leniency with a life sentence, and the decision on Rowling's fate would be up to the jury. Rowling's defense team argued that he did not deserve to be executed for his crimes because of the horrendous upbringing he had suffered at the hands of his father. They also stated that Rowling believed he was possessed by demons, and that this evil side of his personality was the one responsible for the murders.
I'm not saying this is the devil making me do it, okay? Please understand this. This is not the devil I'm trying to say. The concept of the demon working within him comes about primarily from an individual's religious background. Remember, when we're children, we all have concepts of the devil as we learn either from our parents or from religious teachings. So we have a concept of devils or demons. And this concept that we have is what we develop, or the associative person develops later on, and then attributes certain actions or conduct or behavior to the devil or the demon. As I said before, we're not using this as a defense. There is no defense in this case. Mr. Rowling's pled guilty, so it's not a defense. Second, you need to understand that although Mr. Rowling says his actions are influenced by these spirits, he in no way says that he doesn't remember doing it or he didn't do it. He admits, did it, know it, understand it, knew what he's doing. Okay? What these spirits represent or are for him under this dissociative disorder is basically a coping mechanism.
Assistant public defender Johnny Kearns told the jury that Rowling's evil side was called Yenad, which was Danny spelled backwards, adding that it was created by Rowling as a way to cope with his remorse and guilt. He further disclosed that a team of 3 psychiatrists concluded that Rowling was suffering from borderline personality disorder, which is characterized by dramatic mood swings and intense bursts of anger. He then said that it was the defense's belief that he was suffering from a psychosexual disorder, which resulted in him peeping through windows. He revealed that just days before Krista Hoyt was killed, Rowling had watched her undress after a shower. The prosecution rebutted, telling the jury that there were a number of aggravating factors in the case which warranted the death penalty. State Attorney Rod Smith told the jury that before killing his victims, Rowling went into great detail about what he planned to do to them. He detailed the murder of Krista.
and Raymond looks different. On the medicine cabinet window, following message to family, I tried, but I just can't make it. 15 years old. Amazing. 15 years old. Man wrote his own epitaph. Unfortunately, help is never sought. It's a family situation. Okay, this is back in the 60s, early 60s. It's a family situation. There was also fear that maybe an admission that perhaps there is some sort of mental or emotional problems might not sit well with certain family members. So the help that is needed is never sought.
He said that the crimes were especially heinous, atrocious, or cruel, and revealed one disturbing aspect of the murder of Tracy. As Tracy lay bleeding to death, Rowling lingered in the apartment she shared with Manuel. When she finally died, he raped her a second time. State Attorney Smith then spoke about the murder of Sonia. He told the jury that she had been forced to perform oral sex on Rowling. He stated, "She was so thoroughly terrified, she was willing to do anything he demanded to stay alive."
The father's rage, as I stated before, was not solely and exclusively directed towards the mother. Danny seems to be the focus of it also, and there's clear indications that although his brother Kevin was also subject to the same type of conduct, it would appear that as Danny got older, the focus of the father's attention became Danny rather than his brother Kevin, and to a certain extent, lesser on to the mother and more on to Danny. For instance, the type of verbal conduct that the father would exhibit towards Danny would usually consist of phrases such as, "You're no good, you're stupid, you're a failure." These types of words first come about because at one point, Danny has to repeat the third grade.
He then turned his attention to Rowling's childhood and urged the jury not to be softened and said, "The man who sits there is a killer. This man has 22 prior violent felonies spanning over 15 years. The jury ultimately sided with the prosecution, and they sentenced Danny Rowling to death. Ed Humphrey, who was wrongfully accused of the Gainesville murders, was released after 13 and a half months at the State Psychiatric Hospital at Chattahoochee. He found employment cleaning dog kennels and in factories, which helped him pay his way through college. In 2000, he graduated from the University of Central Florida and lives a quiet, anonymous life with his wife. While Rowling was linked to the murders with DNA evidence and a full and detailed confession, a dark cloud of suspicion followed Ed wherever he went due to his connection to the case. From behind bars, Rowling proposed to Sandra London, a true crime author who had once dated serial killer G.J. Schaefer. In 1996, Rowling co-authored a book with his new fiancée titled The Making of a Serial Killer, The Real Story of the Gainesville Murders. It was a grisly and sexually explicit book in which Rowling confessed to the 5 murders in great detail. He stopped short of accepting any responsibility by once again claiming he was possessed by a demon who carried out the murders. Rowling and London were subsequently sued by the state of Florida under the Son of Sam law, which stipulates that criminals cannot profit from their crimes. By October of 2006, Rowling's execution date was fast approaching. He handed his spiritual advisor a handwritten confession to the triple murder of the Grissoms. It read, in part, "I and I alone am guilty. It was my hand that took these precious lights out of this old dark world. With my heart and soul would I could bring them back." Shreveport police had closed the case in 1994 when it became apparent that Rowling was most likely the killer. Caddo Parish District Attorney Paul Carmouche said at the time, "We all know he can only die once." On the 25th of October, 2006, Danny Rowling was led to the execution chamber in Florida State Prison. His voice echoed throughout the chamber as he sang a hymn before being restrained to the gurney around 6 p.m. The adjoining witness room was packed with the loved ones of his many victims. Once strapped in, he turned his head to stare at Ricky Pauls, the mother of Tracy. He once again began to sing and bellowed, "None greater than thee, O Lord, none greater than thee." Rowling was asked if he had any last words. For years, he had claimed to be remorseful for his actions, but he refused to make a final statement. He didn't apologize for the murders or ask for forgiveness from the family members of his victims. The microphone was turned off. At 6:13 p.m., Danny Rowling was pronounced dead. This episode was written and researched by Emily G. Thompson, editing and scoring by Corey Hiltman, script editing, additional writing, and production direction by Rosanna and Benjamin Fitton. For more on our series and notes on this episode, please visit theywalkamonguspodcast.com. And for more on the Law & Crime Podcast Network, please visit lawandcrime.com/podcasts. This has been They Walk Among America. We will be back next week with a new episode. Thank you for listening, and please be safe.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.